Hello and welcome to episode 85 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Bend, Oregon. I'm Andrew Brokus. For those of you who are confused about why episode 85 is showing up in your feed after episode 307, you may have heard some other episodes recently. We've aired a few of these that fit this pattern. In 2014, Nate and I briefly joined the Poker News podcast feed. We were still Thinking Poker. We kept the ordering of episodes from Thinking Poker, but these episodes were not available on the regular Thinking Poker RSS feed, which is what most people are subscribed to and have downloaded. And these episodes have not been available anywhere for a long time. So we're really excited and we're grateful to Russ Fox, who is the person who had downloaded and saved all of these, that he was able to share them with us. We have the rights to air them. We just didn't have the actual audio files, and now we have them and are excited to be sharing them with you. This episode in particular, I think, is one of the most memorable that we've done. This was, I would say, the biggest perk of working with Poker News during the time that we did, which was during the 2014 World Series of Poker. Nate, Carlos Mavis, and myself, Nate Mavis, Carlos Welch, and myself, we got to record from the hallway of the Rios. Maybe you've seen this setup if you've been to the World Series of Poker for a while. Poker News had like a podcasting desk with more professional equipment than what we generally use, set up on location in the hallway of the Rio. And so we got to record there, which was interesting in a variety of ways. I think we maybe talked about this on a subsequent episode, but it felt a little like being in the zoo. You know, there's all these people walking past you and they'll just stop and stare at you, or sometimes even ask you questions or talk to you as though you're not obviously in the middle of recording a podcast. So it was a little weird, but it was fun and it was a very memorable experience. And of course, it's always a special treat to be able to sit down in person with both Nate and Carlos. I think that's when the show is at its very best, when the three of us are able to sit down in person. A lot of my favorite episodes have followed that formula of Nate, Carlos, and myself sitting down together in Las Vegas to record. That's how we first met Carlos. I hope that you'll enjoy this episode. As usual with these, it's important to keep in mind this is a 5-year-old podcast episode, so any reference that we make to something that happened recently or something that's going to happen soon has already happened and was not recent. I believe I've removed all of the original ads that were added to this episode. I do want to tell you, of course, that this is brought to you by Tournament Poker Edge. Was with Tournament Poker Edge in 2014, was with them before 2014, still making videos for them. All the videos that I made in 2014 and before 2014 and all the videos I've made since are available for the same price you would have paid in 2014 at tournamentpokeredge.com. That means you are getting tremendous amount of archival material, 10 plus years worth of videos from myself and many other video producers. Many of us longtime poker pros, and that's available to you for as little as $25 a month at www.tournamentpokeredge.com. All right, enjoy one of my favorite all-time Thinking Poker episodes, episode 55, featuring Carlos Welch live from the Rio, well, not live, but recorded, recorded in person from the hallway of the Rio Convention Center in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Danger is stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 85 of the Thinking Poker Podcast, coming to you from just outside of the Amazon Room in the Rio Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada. I am Andrew Brokus, joined in person by Nate Mavis and Carlos Welch.
How are you?
Hello, everybody.
This is very exciting. This is one of our first ever shows done in person. It is our first ever show done with proper professional recording equipment. I'm excited about this.
Yeah, this is fantastic. I just tweeted out a picture of it if you want to get an idea of just how fancy the setup is. So big thanks to Poker News for setting us up with this.
And by just, Nate means several days before you're hearing this.
That's right.
But scroll back through that Twitter feed and you can find a picture of Carlos and me standing in front of the equipment.
Is anybody else nervous that this is, like, in the public?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are walking by here being like, who are these people I've never seen before? Right. These nobodies sitting behind microphones. Should we alert security?
Yeah. What's amazing is that if you've been to the World Series, you know that there are all these massage stations set up, and we're staring, like right across the aisle at a guy face down in a pillow getting a massage. So it's fantastic. So I've been out here for a week playing a whole bunch of poker, and Andrew just got out here yesterday or the day before, and Carlos has been out here all summer.
Since May 30th, I've been here.
And it's been a good summer for you, Carlos, right?
It's been a great summer,
On and off the felt?
On and off the felt, man. It's been, I've said this for the past 3, maybe 4 years now. Every summer I'll say, okay, this is the best summer ever, and every year it literally just keeps getting better.
Fantastic. So what's better about it this year?
Some of the people I've met, and also I'm not just luck boxing in tournaments like I did last year. I actually know what I'm doing this time. And so I've had better results. I had good results last year, but a lot of that just came from being a nit and other people just being too spewy. But this year I'm more... I feel like I have more control over the tables, and I know why I'm being a nit, and I know when to change gears.
And feel like you're earning it.
Yes. Feel like I'm earning it. I hate to say this, but in some games...
So there's a guy wheeling a cart full of chips outside, so sorry for that.
In some games, it literally feels easy, and I hate to say that, but it, like, because I'm playing against players who don't understand stack size strategy,
right.
it literally feels easy when everybody limps and I just shove and everybody folds. It's like if poker was always like this, you could literally just print money.
And what are you playing?
I'm playing tournaments $300 and below. Mainly, I started the trip off with the dailies at the Aria. And those are 125 buy-ins. I've played Planet Hollywood, $200 buy-in, and then also at Binion's, which is 140.
Because I just want to let people know, for people who aren't familiar with you or haven't listened to a lot of back episodes of the show, I mean, Carlos has been a guest, I don't know, 5-6 times
right.
on the show now. You were a teacher, a public school teacher, up until this time last year, basically.
Yes.
You were out here. You had a pretty good summer. Last summer, decided to leave your job as a school teacher and playing probably smaller stakes than most people would be when they decide to go pro.
Right.
And I think a lot of what's interesting about you is what the things that you've done to keep your costs down so that you can make a living or get by playing relatively small stakes stuff. Because I think a lot of people would love to spend a summer in Las Vegas,
yeah.
but I'm like, well, I don't play big enough to justify doing that. Like, how can I get a hotel room or rent a house or all this stuff? So, I mean, what's your setup out here?
I'll say I agree with what you said about to the average person, and I was the same way before I got here. You pull up WSOP.com, and you look at the schedules, and, like, the smallest tournament is a $1,000 buy-in. And for me, when I first came out here, I wasn't planning on playing any tournaments because I thought that was all that was available. My goal was to come out and play single table satellites all summer and just sell the llamas and make money that way. But when I got here, I found out about the series at Binion's and the series at basically every casino in Vegas besides the Rio have buy-ins that I could afford. And so those are the games I would play, and as far as the cost, when you come out to Vegas, you quickly realize if you're in hotels that they may be affordable Sunday through Thursday, but then Friday and Saturday the price kind of triples or quadruples. And so what I did my first year is I came out for... I guess it was on a Sunday, gave myself a few days to find somewhere cheaper to stay before Friday hit. Otherwise, I would have been sleeping under a bridge somewhere. But luckily, I was able to surf Craigslist and find a lady that lives not far from the Rio that was renting out a bedroom for pretty cheap. And so That's what I did last year.
And this is the woman who was known on last year's podcast as the crazy Brazilian lady.
The crazy Brazilian lady, yes.
And you're back there this year, right?
I'm back there this year. And
it's funny. Too crazy.
This is the funny thing. Like, when I tell people, every person, I say, so where are you staying this year? I'm staying with a crazy Brazilian lady. You stay with a crazy Brazilian lady again? I was like, you know what? It was, she's crazy, but I kind of like her. You know, she's cool. And also, the Tournament Poker Edge TPE house is right around the corner, so I get to go there to avoid some of her nonstop talking when I need to.
She actually called you like during the year to help her with computer problems. Just like in November or something, she would call you up and be like, Carlos, can you help me with my computer?
Dude, she called me to ask me how to print a YouTube video. She wanted to know how to print a YouTube video. And I'm scratching my head thinking, how in your mind do you imagine this working? But I can remember she said, like, okay, when I start the video and I press print, I just get like a solid black box on the paper. I was like, you thought it was going to actually print like an iPad for you? Like, I don't know what she was thinking.
All right, so you're out here, you're playing mostly these $200-$300 buy-in tournaments. Mm-hmm. That's been off to a good start for you so far. How have you found are there other pros who seem to be doing the same thing, or are most of the other people in this tournament amateurs?
Yeah, there's no pros. The other players, I'll say this. I maybe all summer have ran across one or two other players that I thought were competent in terms of adjusting to stack sizes when they get short. Most of these players are decent in that they're aggressive, and that tends to work against overly passive players. And so once the passive players are all, you know, gone by the end of the tournament, then myself and other I'll say semi-competent players are able to exploit the over-aggression from the other players. So to answer your question, I saw a lot of players that looked like they were good because they were aggressive. But as soon as somebody like myself or one or two other people were able to exploit that over-aggression, then their leaks were quickly shown.
How about you, Nate? What have you been doing since you got out here?
I've been playing, I played a 10-game mixed tournament with the gentleman who's just walking by and who's probably going for the restart and who didn't recognize me. That's okay. This guy was fantastic. So he's a European gentleman who wore, I'm not sure if like pillbox hat is the right way to describe it, but it's a more cylindrical than usual hat. He's got like the mustache
that turns
up at the end. And at one point, like the dealer chastised him for saying what he was discarding in a three-handed pot, which you shouldn't do. But, like, it was, like, a very friendly game. Neither me nor the other opponent minded. And afterward, he was trying to explain to the dealer that this was a friendly game. He wasn't doing anything that anybody objected to. And that, like, you know, it wasn't that even though he lost the pot, he was happy to be playing. But his English is not tip-top. So what he said was, he laugh, he laugh, he laugh. He win, I no win.
That is awesome.
Which is fantastic. I need to remember that. He laugh, he win, I no win, you know.
And it makes perfect sense. I know exactly what it means.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, at the end of the day, that was how my tournament went. Other people won, I no win. But it was great. Yeah, but I've been playing a lot of mixed games. I've been playing some 2-5 no limit. I've been playing some Omaha. I've been playing all sorts of things. But the 2040 mix at the Rio right over there has been my game of choice. It's now been populated with games that I've never played before, but that's okay because I know how to fold.
That works in any poker game, huh?
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of them are split pot games, and in limit split pot games, what do? You play tight and you play to scoop, nice. Unless you're getting a really good price. And if you understand that and other people don't, you're going to get the money.
What are these games that you've never played, like Badoosi?
Badoosi I've played a few times before. So Super Raz Doogie, Super Stud 8 or better, like all the Super Stud games. just like plain old Rez Doogie is also something I haven't.
I actually don't know what Super Stud is.
So Super Stud is So the super prefix on a stud mm-hmm. game means that everybody gets four down cards and one up card at the beginning of the hand, and you play Third Street the way you normally would, and then everybody discards two cards before Fourth Street. So you just get to choose two out of four down cards. So it just strengthens the starting hands, among other things. It gives you more knowledge of the deck, and that makes it very likely that you're going to have to reshuffle the muck in a very in a very loose game. So
do they just like invent new games every year? Like yeah, where are these games coming from?
I mean, I think so. I think this started off at the high stakes. I think they also like to play Roll Your Own, where you get five cards face down, and then before Fourth Street, you roll one and you pitch two. I think there's an interesting story to be told about the economics of high stakes poker, where it used to be that you could get enough loose action at Hold'em and Stud and the horse games to make it okay to play with world experts in all these games. And over time, it's possible that some of that money dried up, which I think explains the shift to like crazier and crazier variants, because I think now at the highest stakes, people are focusing less on getting casual players to drop by, because like some random rich chef from New Jersey is probably not going to stop by to play 4,000 Super Stud or Super Rez Doogie. But I think that, say, Stinger thinks he might have an edge over some grinding pro in those games. So that's like my speculation. But yes, like actually now I do show up, and every year there are new games I've never played before, and that's okay.
I've always thought that like a true World Series of Poker, or a poker tournament that was meant to find the best poker player in the world, would be played in a game that no one had ever played before, that was like invented just for the, because that really tests your understanding of poker concepts as opposed to the fact that you like, because a lot of people have learned Hold'em strategy either through trial and error or through imitation of things that they see on poker videos, tournamentpokeredge.com. So I think that like having a game that forces you just to apply poker principles in a new context might be the best way of testing like who actually understands poker and not just one specific game.
Yeah, I think so. I think David Sklansky once wrote that if we really did that, though, the World Series of Poker would be won by bridge players.
Yeah.
But I on this note, I played the 10 game yesterday, as I've mentioned already. I've got a bunch of hands to talk about. Should we start talking about some of those, or are there more general Las Vegas chat things you'd like to do before we do that?
No, I just got here yesterday, so I don't really have any general Las Vegas. 2 days ago, I don't really have any general Las Vegas chat for you.
I will say this very generally, and we can get back into it later if we want to. The people that I've met this year have been phenomenal. I got a chance to spend some time with Keone, who was one of the past guests on the show. He's a really great guy. He's hilarious, hilarious. He and Briar and Russell, who are two guys that I met through the podcast that actually live in Atlanta, where I'm from, and they came out with me. And so just spending time with those guys, all the guys at the TPE house, and all the listeners of Thinking Poker and members of TPE that just recognize me in tournaments and come up to me and, like, you know, we'll hang together for 2 days, and, like, just the bonds that you meet. As Riverman from TPE, one of the pros, comes up and takes a picture. I met him for the first time here. Like, these bonds that you meet.
I'm glad you knew who that was, because I had no idea who this was. Stopping and taking our picture.
Yeah, he's a good friend, James Lambert. The people that you meet in poker that you wouldn't meet any other place in your life, like, that's what I like more about the game than even the strategy, even the money that's in it. And that's why I try to consider myself like the anti-Sheldon Adelson. Like, he's talking about, like, you know, poker is like sponsoring terrorism and stuff. And I see the completely opposite side of that with the relationships that I've built with random strangers. So that's been like the off the felt part that made this summer that one of the best summers of my life.
Nice. Well, hopefully we can play a small part in that as well.
Yes.
So can I tell you about a single draw hand that I think has some important principles behind it?
Yeah, so this is deuce to seven, no limit.
This is deuce to seven, no limit, single draw. So there's a little bit of history that's relevant. Again, six-handed tournament. I've got a pretty tight image I haven't said much of anything either, which I think ends up mattering. So the previous hand, I raise under the gun with a 7 draw. Tim Finn calls me, and nobody else does. Goes heads, you know, so we're heads up to the draw. It's 1-1. I draw one card, he draws one card. I pair sevens and bluff half pot, which is very, very, very standard. I mean, if I think he's really call happy, then maybe I shouldn't have any bluffing range at all. And it looked like he was looking to build up a stack or go home. But I think he's not going to play terrible. He's going to fold something sometimes. So if I'm going to bluff with anything, pair of sevens is both a bad hand and a hand with a lot of blockers. So I bluff. He calls with a jack. Okay. So the very next hand, a guy named Bill. He's a pro from New Jersey, a strong player, and a very friendly guy. I hadn't met him before. He raises. He gets called by a strong player on the button. I call out of the big blind with a 7-6-5-4, which, I mean, you wouldn't want to have a straight draw, but it's a 7 draw, and I'm getting a good price. There are antes in this game. It's a very standard call, I think. I mean, maybe not. I don't know. but I think re-raising and folding. I mean, re-raising in a game like this is probably never all that bad, just because people play pretty tight. But I like the call. So it goes 1-pat-2. So Bill is pat. The guy who called on the button is drawing 2. I draw 1. I pair sevens again, and I think this is a really good bluff spot. And here's why: a lot of people don't bluff twice in a row. And, you know, again, I have blockers. I can see 5 cards between 3 and 7. And a lot of his pat hands are going to be pretty weak. So I think he should have a lot of, like, queens and jacks there. I think, a pat queen or a pat jack, it makes sense to try to pick up the pot with that. And then even after you're in a three-handed pot, like, if you don't have a smooth draw, what are you going to do other than stand pat and play after the draw? So I think... Yeah, I think I'm going to bet out with some of my better made hands. I think that he does have to worry a little bit about the guy who drew 2, and I think that he won't expect me to bluff twice in a row. I haven't been caught bluffing or haven't even played many hands yet, you know. So I think this is a case where, like, my first instinct was to just try to make a hand, and then I thought through the situation and I saw that I had a really good bluffing spot. Does that make sense to you?
Your reasoning all makes sense. The thing that I have difficulty judging one way or the other is, like, what the guy's opening range would look like at the first. Just, like, never having played a hand of deuce to seven no limit, it's hard for me to, like, conceptualize what his opening range would look like and which of those hands he would end up patting in a three-way pot.
So I think he would, of the hands that he would open and then pat, I think... The table was playing pretty tight, and he was not unwilling to try to pick up the pot. I think if he has a pat jack or a pat queen, even, I think he would open some of those. Like, the antes were such that he was getting even money or better on an ante steal, and I think that's fine. Of those, I think he could fold. I mean, I think he probably wouldn't fold a 10. I mean, he might fold a 10 if he thinks I think he won't fold a 9. I think he probably won't fold a 10. I think he will fold a lot of jacks, especially his worst jacks. And his worst jacks are going to be the ones he's likeliest to pat to. And I think he's quite likely to fold a queen, which is a pure bluff catcher, I think. And just combinatorially, if he's opening most of the queens he's dealt, or even a good chunk of the queens that he's dealt, or most of the jacks that he's dealt, then this bluff has a very good chance of working, I think.
So is this also a pretty good value betting spot for you then? I mean, it seems like both he and the player who drew 2 need to call you somewhat, or like are not going to have strong hands all that often.
That's right. So in No Limit Deuce to 7, nobody has a 7 all that often. You know, like a 10 is a great hand, right? So I do think, I mean, I will bet out for value here. I think it'll go check, check, check quite a lot. So I think the guy with the one card draw should bet sometimes, and should also, should value bet and should bluff sometimes. So I will make some value bets. I do think that if I bet... partly given some of the dynamic sort of features of the situation, it's going to go fold pretty often because it's hard to make anything when you draw 2. So yeah, I would both value bet and bluff there. Results, it worked. He thought for a while. And I mean, I think he made a fold. I think he had like a bad jack or something like that. And he just decided, like, he can really only beat a bluff. And he decided I wasn't bluffing and he folded. And then I got lucky and the guy who drew two didn't make anything. And I won the pot.
I guess like anytime you draw one and end up pairing, that's going to be the bottom of your range. And if, like, yeah, and when you pair like an important blocker like a seven, that becomes like your best bluffing. So just like as a matter of balance,
that's right.
That's always going to be like the best bluffing candidate.
That's right. And pairing seven, and I mean pairing sevens is very different from pairing deuces also, right? Because it's not that hard to pair in this game, and a pair of deuces is not the worst bluff catcher sometimes, actually. So especially pairing sevens, especially induced to seven, like pairing sevens and pairing fives, because those are big and those are like blockers. But I do think that on a sort of mental preparation level, looking for bluff spots and not just trying to make a hand is important also in Hold'em. Like, even if you never play a hand with no limit deuce to seven in your life, I think one thing that I still don't do as well as I should in Hold'em is find spots to bluff into strength, into shown strength. Like, he's probably not snowing there often, right? Like, he would probably just draw three and take a shot if he was opening with nothing, which he probably wasn't in the first place. And like, I have an easy time trying to knock people off of bottom pair or ace high and hold them. I have a harder time trying to run people off a top pair or something like that.
I have a harder time trying not to run people off.
Yeah. I was just thinking that.
Like, if I know for sure you have top pair, it's pretty hard for me to all just in. Be like, I'll just let him have it.
Yeah. I think I talked to Andrew not long ago about the hands that he would post on thinkingpoker.com, and I was like, every hand, it just wasn't okay. This guy can't have a monster, all in on the river. I was like, man, poker's easy. Yeah, but that bluffing and the strength, I think that's hard for a lot of people.
It's tough, and it's definitely a work in progress for me. It's definitely good. So I've got a triple draw hand here. I've got another no limit deuce to seven hand. I've got a Badoogie hand. Any preferences here?
Let's stay on the deuce to seven for the moment. On the no limit deuce to seven.
No limit deuce to seven. Okay, so this one's easy. This one's one that Thayer told me. So I had Thayer to my left for a couple hours. Good thing he was short stacked, because I think he plays a lot better than I do. So Thayer's got 5,400 after posting a 75 big blind. I think it was like a 15 ante, 50 small blind, 75 big blind. Tim Finn playing very aggressively opens for 200. Another guy who's been fighting with Tim a little bit. I mean, not interpersonally, but
battling.
Yeah. Battling Tim a bit. Three bets to 600, and I think those stack sizes are both about, I think, like 3K. I think Tim had about 3K. The other guy had about 6K. So it goes 200, and then button re-raised to 600. Thayer's in the big blind with a pat 10-8 and about 5,400. And this is just like a math question. I don't know. But I'm pretty sure. He says he folded, and I think that's a mistake. I think Tim can be opening a lot of even two-card draws. I think the button can be three-betting a lot of pat hands or one-card draws even. And a pat 10-8, I would 4-bet and take it from there. It's really hard to make a 10, and a 10-8 is pretty good among 10s. And what to do if you get if you get 5-bet, I think, is a tougher situation. I don't really like cold calling. I think you're likely to get less value. Like, I think by 4-betting, you can represent even like a premium one card draw or a hand like that, or even maybe a jack. I mean, if he's folding a 10, I guess it might be hard to represent a jack by 4-betting. But I know in that spot, I would have 4-bet to, I don't know, 1,900 or something, and you know, set up about a pot size. Yeah, it bet sizing larger to decrease your positional disadvantage after the draw, I think, is a good idea. And I don't think I could have folded that hand, especially given that. Tim could have easily been opening two card draws, and the button was battling with him a little bit. It's seems a lot like folding jacks or queens or something in that spot and hold them, just to make a bad analogy. That said, Thayer is Thayer, and I'm not there. And I did not get fifth in the monster stack. So But I think it's an interesting spot. And I also think, you know, it's you know, we just talked a lot about having poker fundamentals and how that's enough. And sometimes it's not enough. Like, I don't exactly know what to do with this hand because I'm not an expert in this game. And I don't know exactly,
yeah,
like, what
I'm
percentage
really
of the opening
taking
range
taking your
is
word here.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think about, like, trying to somehow wrap my hold of mind around, like, well, how often do I see a flop that has three cards, 10 or lower?
Yeah.
Plus, how often are you dealt two cards, 10 or lower, and what are your odds of not pairing those? Just to kind of conceptualize, like, what does it mean to get five low
right.
cards? Like, how often does that happen?
I mean, one way to think about this is, boy, I could be wrong about this, but I think if you know that somebody has a pack queen or worse, it's about 50-50 for them to have a queen or not. And if you know that somebody has a pack jack or worse, it's about 50-50 for them to have a jack or not. And that those numbers could be off significantly, but they might be sort of in the ballpark of right. So a 10 is really good. and a pat hand beats a one-card draw a lot. So
those seem like important facts to know before you start playing just the 7-no limit.
Yeah. And, I mean, a 10-8, like, a 10-8 is better than a lot of... This is one thing, like, big difference between a 10-9 and a 10-8. So, among 10s, a lot of them are 10-9s. So, I think Thayer made a very, very, very big fold here. And that said, he did have a sucker with some chips on his right. So, you can imagine him valuing his tournament life.
It's funny, like, the spectrum of mixed game knowledge here. So, I'm listening to you talk intelligently about mixed games, but with admittedly limited experience versus a guy like Thayer. And then Andrew is talking about trying to relate what he knows about Hold'em to the mixed game. And then I'm down here just in my mind laughing every time you say Pat Jack, because I'm thinking about Pat Sajak. And everything else y'all saying makes no sense to me. All I know is a little bit about Hold'em, and I can kind of understand how people feel when you talk to them about Hold'em. And they don't, like, you know, for the first time, they never heard this stuff. Like when you say Pat, I kind of got an idea just based on what I know of the definition of that word,
yeah,
what that means. But experience with the game, I don't have at all. But it's funny because just listening to the spectrum of mixed game knowledge. I will say that you mentioned some concepts from the first game that, I use sometimes in Hold'em, the blockers,
yeah,
and knowing what, like, you know, just trying to use what you can see to guess what you guess about what you can't see. So I can kind of relate a little bit, but there's a lot I have to learn about the other, and it's going to be so hard because we just mentioned they're inventing new games every year.
Yeah.
What you just said about using what you can see to guess at what you can't see, I like the way you put that, and that is a lot of what you're... I mean, that's what hand reading is in, mm-hmm, poker. And really, you have two sources of information about that. You have your opponent's actions, mm-hmm, and you have whatever cards you get to see. And that's one of the huge differences between games like Hold'em or Stud versus draw games. Because in Hold'em and Stud, you get to see some of your opponent's cards. And in draw games, the only cards you get to see are cards that are dealt to you. So
yeah,
the idea of blockers become way more important, I would say.
In mixed games.
Nate agrees in this.
Yeah.
In mixed games, because that's all you get, is all you know is what cards are not in your opponent's hands. You don't get to see any of the cards that are in your opponent's hands.
Right.
So that it becomes way more important to use those to make your decisions. I mean, if you're trying to implement game theory at all, using the cards that you've seen to decide when to bluff and when not to bluff and when your hand is worth value betting or not, that's the only information you get from seeing cards is whatever you have in your hand or have discarded.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll say this, though, and I don't know if a lot of people do this related to that fact. When I'm playing Hold'em and I'm in a hand where, say, I'm under the gun with, like, ace of hearts, deuce of spades, and I fold it under the gun, I will pay attention to the hand, and if there's a I can't remember, ace of hearts, I said. And so if there's a heart draw out there and a guy is betting like he has the nut flush, then I will use that, even when I'm not in the hand, to kind of develop the idea of this guy's bluffing range or this guy, you know, so.
Yeah, that's valuable.
But you can use blockers even when you're not in the hand to build your understanding of the other player's strategies.
Yeah, absolutely. Or I think as commonly for me, it's like I'll fold, say, 9-3 or something like that, and the flop will come like king 9-9 and three people give a lot of action. It's like, well, two of those people don't have
right.
nines.
Right.
At least. So.
Figure out who's bluffing, man.
Yeah.
Jump in here quickly before you move on to your next game and say that although Tournament Poker Edge does not currently have a lot of mixed game content on there, it's something that we're actively looking to improve. So I can tell you both that Tournament Poker Edge is actively looking to hire a mixed game coach of some sort or a mixed game video producer. So if you have someone in mind or if you yourself think that you might be a good candidate for that, be sure to get in touch with us, I guess, podcast@thinkingpoker.net, and we can pass you on to the appropriate person. And also, if you're interested in Thinking Poker in mixed game tournament content, Tournament Poker Edge will soon be the place for you. And if you are also interested in no limit content with a small mix of mixed game content, don't hesitate to sign up for tournamentpokeredge.com.
I think I might have just found a candidate. So stay tuned.
I'm sitting right here, man. If you think you're better than me at talking about mixed games, then apply tournamentpokeredge.com.
Nice.
So one interesting tournament adjustment is that people play a bit tighter than they usually do, especially after raises. People worry more about their tournament lives, and a raise either takes the pot or it puts your opponent into check call mode often. And that's very different from cash games, where people are, you know, play as if they can get more money, and they play as if not every raise means the nuts. So even when you have a very strong hand, it can make sense to think that you're probably only going to get one raise in at some point. And this I think makes for some interesting adjustments. So there was an 08 pot where it went limp. I limped behind on the button with king jack 10-4 single suited to the king, complete check. So I think we were five handed to the flop, and it came king jack 4. Sorry, I didn't have a 4, I had a 3. And there was a flush draw, and it went bet call, and then I called with king jack, which is, I mean, it's going to be hard for me to win the pot, but I'm getting excellent pot odds. And I mean, top two pair is unlikely to be the best hand by the river, or even already, but especially because people do like to limp with high card hands. But I'm getting a good price, and I can't fold. Turns a jack. Check. So the better checks, next guy checks. Limp. The limper who called the flop bet bets. Next guy folds. In a cash game, I think I would raise here. But I'm probably only going to get one raise in, so I called to see if I could get a call out of one of the two guys in the blinds, and then I raised the river. So it turned out he had a set of fours, so he had fours full of jacks on the turn. I'm not sure that my play was good, but I think it's a lot better in a tournament than it is in a cash game. I think in a cash game I should raise and maybe try to get three bet by a full house or something like that. I mean, not that three betting a full house worse than jacks full is going to be a good play, but it'll happen sometimes.
Right.
And but in a setting like this, I think it makes sense to call, try to get a call from get a crying call from, say, a combo draw or something like that, or like, you know, jack 10 9 8 or something like that. I mean, it's, or maybe queen, a hand like queen jack 10 or something like that has a jack and a straight draw now. That's a hand I would like to call, obviously.
And, yeah, that makes sense.
And that's a hand that could also make a heroic fold that could easily fold. You know, if it goes bet raise, yeah. I mean, put yourself in that spot. It comes king, jack, four, jack. and then it's been raised to you, and you have Queen Jack 10 and 9.
In like a four-way pot.
In a four-way pot. I mean, you could make that fold, right?
Yeah.
But for just a call, you might peel one off there. Yeah.
I mean, it seems basically impossible to raise there if you can't beat trips.
Yeah. So, I think that's a tournament adjustment. Now that I think about it, calling might be correct even in a cash game. But I do think it's a case where some of these tournament dynamics change the correct play a lot.
I wonder too how much the mixed game dynamic becomes relevant. Like that, certain people I assume are playing a lot tighter in some games because they think they have a really big edge in other games,
yeah.
And then there are some games that they're just like wildly unfamiliar with and are just folding almost everything. Is that something that you try to pay attention to identify, like this guy is strong in this game, this guy's weak in that game?
Yeah. Like the 55-year-old guy with the pinky rings and the, and the glasses on the very
stud.
And then the very, very edge of his nose. He's not, he knows his stud. He might know No Limit Lowball or something like that. Probably like No Limit Hold'em. He's tightening up a little bit. That's a blind you want to go after. But he's probably way better at stud than I am. So, those guys are awesome, by the way. You should want to play with them.
Right. And what about you personally? I mean, was that an adaptation that you made? Were there games where you tightened up?
Pot Limit Omaha, especially. It's sort of interesting because I have read through some of, at least, Quick Pro, Johnny's book that he was kind enough to give me for free, even though it cost $400. $300?
$300.
Yeah. But
either way, Nick asked.
Yeah. I mean, but a guy like Thayer is going to be way, way, way better than me. So, like,
that's the thing. It's not really about how much you know. It's how much you know compared to what other people know.
Yeah.
Because, like, you still, I'm sure, know more about PLO than you do about, like, just a 7 single draw.
Yeah.
But the relative skill difference between you and some other people is probably a lot smaller in single draw.
Exactly. And, like, take a hand like deuce to 7 triple draw, where there are some people who are much better than me and who would laugh at the knowledge I have of the game. But, like, I've got a lot of muscle memory of at least playing sort of fundamentally okay. I put in a lot of hours in the Bellagio 40 mix back in the day. And so I've got, I'm just not going to make that many huge, huge, huge mistakes, or at least fewer than the next guy. And although the best players have an edge over me, people who haven't played a lot of deuce to 7 triple draw, like, that's a game where if your ranges are wrong from the beginning, if you make bad drawing decisions, if you do things wrong, I mean, you're making huge, huge, huge mistakes. So that's, that's a game that I look to play. So I was tightening up during the Omaha, against people who are really looking to gamble. Like, if you think that you might not want to get tons and tons of money in a big bet game, you might want to wait for the limit games. I think Badoogie is a game where you see a lot of fundamental mistakes all over the place. That was a game that I was looking forward to a lot. And also Stud High it's both a high variance game and a game that, although I have some muscle memory for, although I've studied the game and played it, the best players are a lot better than me at it.
That's a game I feel really uncomfortable with.
Yeah, it's just tough. I mean, thankfully I have some experience. I know how to memorize up cards. I know how to think about liveness. I know how to think about sort of re-raising versus calling versus folding when a probable pair opens and I've got a smaller pair next to act.
This is why I didn't play the 10 game.
But it's tough. And, like, it's the boards get scary and it's just a very difficult game. But, yeah, I definitely tighten up during some of it.
Nate, can you find games like this outside of the WSOP?
That's a good question. I was talking to that guy Bill from New Jersey. They have mixed games there. I think there's Badoosi finally got approved in Atlantic City. There's some of that. I think in Las Vegas you can find there's a mixed game with the Aria that's 9-18 that has a bunch of these games in it. And there are big mixes at the Bellagio all year. If you want to play like 20-40 in like Super Raz Doogie, that's probably a thing you can only find here during World Series time. I think at Foxwoods, there's like, I think that 75-150 HOE still goes.
What about tournaments?
Tournaments, online.
Oh, yeah.
Online, I think, I think that's about it. I mean, I imagine the Borgata maybe a couple times a year as a horse tournament or something like that. But right. But if you want to play 10 games in a tournament, you pretty much have to go online.
And if you want to do it for reasonable stakes, it has to be during W Cooper Scoop.
Yeah, that's probably right.
I mean, the difference in the knowledge level between the lower level just getting involved in the game guys and the guys that are kind of like at a mid-level who pretty much know the fundamentals seems so huge. And it's what I'm getting at is you come here to the WSOP during the summer and you play these games against the best people in the world at these games. Yeah. And I'm wondering, like, can you find tournaments that are just where you're going to be the best player in the tournament?
That's tough. I think Full Tilt and PokerStars run like 10-game tournaments.
Right.
And
yeah, I mean, if you want to play like a $5 10-game tournament.
If you play small enough.
I mean, I don't know what type of...
you just probably have to play for stakes that are beneath the best players, basically.
Right, right. And I don't know what type of ROI you can get playing those, maybe multi-tabling or something, but... It seems like that gap is so big in skill level that it's got to be like printing money. Trying to compare it, I mean, you can tell me if this is close or not. It sounds like playing Hold'em against somebody who doesn't know that a flush beats a straight.
Not knowing the rules, although I did play against at least one person who didn't know. I mean, not saying who it is. Right. There's somebody who seemed to be a very intelligent person and a skilled big bet player who, even when he busted, had not yet figured out how much you could bet on different streets and limit games.
That seems like a very fundamental thing.
That's a fundamental thing.
And if you have, maybe I'm picking the wrong example.
Yeah, but you're about right. You're about right. I mean, that's right.
So I'm just imagining, like, if I could play, and this is like one of my goals in folk poker, is to, like, I want to play tournaments where I'm likely to be one of the best players in the tournaments.
That's a good goal to have.
Yeah, right. That's good.
I don't want to play WSOP events where, you know, I may have to play against some of the best in the world or even people. I don't want to be at a table where there's five people on my level.
Right.
Maybe one. If there's one person that understands the gap concept, I feel like I got a bad table draw.
Right.
And so... It sounds like that's possible in these mixed games.
It is. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Like, if you want to go play $2, $4, I mean, there are some good players. So, like, a guy like Mark Gritter on 2+2 back in the day would play small stakes online. So you'll find people who know what they're doing even at small stakes. But, like, if you want to play against people who don't know the rules, if you want to play against people who, you know, to use the Hold'em analogy, don't know that pocket sevens is a lot worse than top pair on a Jack 10-3 board or something like that. Like, then Carlos is smiling right now. Yeah. Sort of wistfully staring in the middle distance.
Because, like, I've been resistant to learn mixed games because I want to focus on getting where I need to be and hold 'em.
I think that's good, though. I think that's right. I think that's correct. I think the money's going to be in hold 'em for a while, especially if you want to play small and medium stakes.
Yeah.
And, I think this is something we talked about. I think Andrew benefited from just studying Hold'em and being as good as he could be at, like, Hold'em cash games and Hold'em tournaments and things like that. And I think I sometimes let my pluralism about poker get in the way of getting to true expertise in anything. Mm-hmm. And I think even if your long-term goal is to know a lot of games, I think actually getting to the expert level in Hold'em is the best way to get good at mixed games that rather than learn a little bit about all the games, like figuring out what expertise is like in a single form of poker, I think is the best way to go. I think that's the best way to learn in the long term.
Okay.
You do see, like, the Phil Galfonds, the Brian Townsends just jumping right in at, like, the 1,000, 2,000 level to learn a game. And I imagine a lot of that has to do, I mean, A, they probably have friends who can tell them some basic things about the game, but a lot of it just has already having a very good understanding of poker so that they can translate a lot of that into a new game pretty quickly.
Right.
And also just, like, having enough money that they're okay with being a dog in those games for a little bit.
In at least one case, I know that transition was aided by a very expensive coach, and it was worth it or whatever, but it's like, you know, they have a bankroll, they have expert-level knowledge of something, and they can hire an $X-hundred-an-hour coach or trade Hold'em coaching for mixed-game coaching, and then all of a sudden the 400, 800 games on PokerStars don't look as scary to them.
Right, speeds of the learning process.
Yeah. But
I will say, though, I mean, I do feel like the what forays I've made into non-Hold'em games and, like, trying to understand a bit of strategy for those games, I have found helpful in Hold'em as well. And I do think that's something I've talked about on here before, so I don't want to repeat myself too much. But I think especially it's a nice thing to do if you're a little bit, tilted or, like, lacking confidence in whatever your regular game is or just sick of it. And sometime when you're looking for a break or don't feel like you're at your best playing your other game, wanting to play smaller stakes than you usually do for whatever reason. I mean, I often enjoy, like, I don't really play Hold'em just recreationally anymore. Like,
right.
It's not interesting for me to sit down and play a small stakes Hold'em game just to, like, pass the time.
Right.
I'd rather read a book than sit in a 1-2 game. I can basically do both, so I do.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I will sit in a 1-3 game waiting for a bigger game to open up and just take out a book and mostly be reading.
Right.
But, like, if I were forced to choose between the two, I would just read a book instead of sit and play 1-3 Hold'em.
Yeah.
But I will go and play 1-3 PLO, even though the rake on it is absurd. Because that's actually interesting.
It's a challenge.
To me. And yeah, it's like it stretches my mind a little bit. It's fun. It's not something I've done a million times already.
Mm.
So I do think that's like studying some mixed games can be a nice way of mixing it up and getting in some poker practice at a time when, for whatever reason, you don't feel like playing your regular game. And I do think you'll learn some things from those mixed games that you can then take back to your regular game and help you to think through some situations maybe better or differently than you used to.
Right.
Especially in these limit games, like, fearless value betting is a skill that, like, if you don't do it, you're probably a sucker in the game. So this is something that comes up a lot in stud. It comes up a lot in draw games where maybe you have a... So I've got a hand right here where I've got a bad eight on the end.
Right.
And I've been betting into two people the whole way. And some guy drew one on the end. And, you know, you just have to go value bet your hand. Maybe you could be snowing. Maybe he's going to call. Maybe he's going to make a 10 and call you. Maybe he's going to make a 9 and call you. I've got all this card removal. He's probably not going to make an 8 on me. and if he does, and if I check, he's just going to bet anyway, and I'm going to lose the same bet. And, like, just bet folding the river or bet making a real decision on the river, like,
right.
It's a great way to strengthen that muscle, which is something I still have a little bit of a trouble with in big bet games. You know, this is something Andrew talks about a lot. Like, what are you scared of? Are you scared of being raised and put in a tough position? Like, if you're raised, can't you just fold?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, maybe you have to call. Maybe it's something that's going to be a bad spot when it happens, but it's only going to happen 5% of the time. You know, you just got to, you know, buckle up and make that value bet on the end. And that can be a lot easier to do when you're betting 20 into 200 and
yeah.
The race that you're going to face is only going to be to 40.
Right.
But it's like, it's really good, you know, when you got two small pair in stud and you've got somebody with, straight and flush possibilities who's drawing on the end. Very often, you just got to make that value bet. And if he raises you with a flush, he raises you with a flush. Maybe
yeah.
You can fold, maybe you can't. But much more often, he's going to back into a pair and call you.
Okay, quick thin value bet question while we're on the subject. Mm-hmm. And this, sorry, guys, this is from a no-limit game because I'm a no-limit fish. so this is from a 10-25 game I played last night. I opened the button with 7-5 suited, opened to $75, and the big blind, who seems like a very competent, good player, mm-hmm. calls. The flop came 2-4-8. So I have a gut shot.
Mm-hmm.
He checks and calls a bet of approximately half the pot. Turn is a 9, and we both check.
Yeah.
And then the river is a 7, so I make a pair, and he checks again. So I have 7-5, and the final board is 2-4-8-9-7. Would you value bet that?
That's a tough question. You know anything about this guy? Like, pre-flop calling tendency? Is he a real blind defender? Is he?
I got the sense he was defending relatively wide from the big blind.
And how deep were you? Were you deep enough that he should be not wanting to check raise a ton on a board like that? Like how?
Yeah, I'd say we're probably like $5,000 effective.
Okay, so that makes me think makes it harder for him to check raise a hand like an 8 or 9s or something like that, which maybe he wouldn't want to do anyway. So, I think I would check there. I think he's, especially if he's strong, he's not going to pay off with any pair just for fun.
Let me. What's your hand? You have.
I have 7-5.
Which is one pair.
Right. It's which is
third pair with a bad kicker.
Yeah. Right. But no, I mean the way the board. The flop was like 8-4 deuce, and he called a bet, and then so like the big cards came later, and he called a bet on the flop, and so I mean it's sort of like how many hands with deuces and fours in them is he really calling out of the big blind? You know, I do think like pocket fives and pocket sixes, pocket threes could all make sense for him. And there's a question of like when he checks the river, I think he's more likely to bet an eight than to check it.
Right.
If he had flopped top pair, I think there's a pretty decent chance that he bets it. So I mean, a lot of it just comes down to like how likely is it that he's checking a hand better than mine? I think so, that's the because I think I have the best hand really often.
So the question is, if we think he is the type of person to make like an extremely thin hero call.
It might not even be that thin. Like, let's say he had ace jack and he didn't want a three bet or something like that. Like, it's not the worst call in the world. I mean, I don't know ace jack, but I think the hands you listed are probably more likely. But.
So if he has fives and has three overs, that's not a thin call.
I mean, because Andrew should be opening a lot and he should be betting the flop with a lot of his nothing, and then
let's just assume that I bet 100% of my opening range on the flop, which on that board I think is pretty reasonable.
Right.
So I mean, my range is extremely wide.
Yeah.
This actually was an article I wrote. I think it was not the most recent, but the month before last, the June 2+2.
Mm-hmm. Good article.
Article was like, what happens to all the weak hands?
Right.
Because a lot of people just say like, well, he could have this, and yeah, like I could have paired the turn, I could have paired the river, I did pair the river.
Right.
I could have checked aces on the turn for whatever reason. There's plenty of strong hands I could have. Like obviously, pocket threes could easily be beaten here. Mm-hmm. But you know, I also have a ton of really weak hands. I raised the button, which obviously I'm going to do with a lot of hands. I see bet the flop, which I'm like, especially in that spot, just called by the big blind, and then a really dry flop like that, I'm probably just betting 100% of my range. And then I check the turn, which subtracts some of the strongest hands from my range, and doesn't subtract a lot of air from my range, because it's a reasonable check with a ton of, I mean, I'll bet a lot of draws, but I mean, there's a ton of hands that are just nothing that I'm going to check on the turn. So I get to the river with plenty of hands I could bluff with. Okay. If you decide that you're just going to fold, you know, anything that can't beat third pair, you're probably folding too much.
Yeah, I guess what I missed there was a turn check. I think that makes it more likely that your river bet is a bluff, I think. I'm thinking that this guy has, say, fives on this board, and you bet. Then I think the river would be a thin call.
Yeah, and probably the turn is a bad call.
Yeah.
But yeah, the fact that I don't bet the turn. Now,
yes.
It's just one bet on the river. A lot of stronger hands have been subtracted from my range.
Okay.
I still have a ton of air that I could be bluffing with. So yeah. you do need to pick a defending frequency there, or else if it turns out that I am going to bluff in this spot, then it's going to be a really profitable bluff if you don't call often enough. And assuming that you want to bet a lot of your stronger hands after I check back the turn, which you probably should, because I have a lot of hands I'm just going to try to show down cheaply. You know, including in this case, I did not end up betting my hand.
Right.
Whereas like I might have considered calling a bet with it.
Okay. And so the question is, should you value bet this river? I can see it because, I mean, like, is this the type of person that would check raise bluff? Do we know?
That actually played into my checking mind. Basically, I felt like I had thought long enough about it that it was pretty clear that I was like a thin value bet. Where I was like, A, he's probably not going to, like, it makes it less likely that he's going to pay off. And B, it could put me in a dicey spot if he raises.
Yeah, right.
So I ended up checking back kind of for that reason. And then he was like, oh, you were thinking about getting thin there, huh?
Yeah.
So he was the type that could, you know.
I mean, he knew, like when he saw my hand, he knew what I was thinking about.
Oh, it's okay.
I mean, I wasn't thinking about open mucking.
Right.
Yeah. By the way, I just tweeted a picture of you guys.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, I think one important factor in this hand is that a lot of your hands that were bluffing the flop pick up a straight draw on the turn. Like, I think it matters a lot what you would do with jack 10, queen 10, queen jack on the turn that now have overs and a gutter and overs and an open-ended straight draw.
I'd be betting those.
Yeah, so that I think changes the shape of your range in a non-obvious way. I think that's a lot of combos.
Even like 7-6.
Yeah.
I mean, some hands that pair the river would be betting the turn as a semi-bluff.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So maybe you don't want to bet this on the river because if you're betting those hands that picked up draws and you're obviously betting your nutted hands and you're probably betting, I'm guessing there's some hands with no showdown value that you're betting. If you also bet this, then you're going to be betting too much on the river, which makes you exploitable?
Well, no, it's more, so a lot of the hands that you mentioned are hands that I would have bet on the turn. Nate's point is like, I'm not going to have a lot of straights on the river because I would have bet the straight draws on the turn.
Right.
I'm not going to have 7-6 to have paired the 7 on the river because I would have bet that on the turn.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, that's the...
Down to the right.
Love it. I love it.
We were warned that people were going to ask us for directions before sitting here recording.
Rich Ryan, man. He called it. I mean, like, that's, you know, I mentioned Shamu earlier. Like, the guy, you know, we're just sitting here in our natural environment, you know, doing our thing, and a guy just comes up eating, like, beer nuts or something, and just eating, just licking
snacking
us.
Snacking and
stuff. Yeah, corn nuts is what they're called. And it's like, that's poker people. And then, you know, you got on headphones and you're talking in a microphone. He's like, are you recording? Is this live? Obviously. This is amazing.
Yeah. No, I think that's tough, though. I think that's a tough spot. I probably would have checked, but I can see the argument for betting.
Yeah, I'm a fish. I checked.
Yeah.
And he had ace deuce. I don't know if you would have called, but...
So you said you're a fish. You think the check is incorrect?
Yeah, the more I think about it, I mean, it would be kind of interesting to take pen to paper, but I think that's actually close to the top of my range.
I was just about to ask that, yes.
I mean, considering how, like, by top of my range here, I mean...
Based on the turn check.
Yeah, and, like, top is pretty big because my range is huge.
Right.
I have plenty of bluff candidates to balance. I mean, if I assume that he's not really checking in a balanced way, which a lot of people aren't, which maybe you even don't need to be, then it's just kind of like betting a... Like, you can, even if he occasionally has a stronger hand than, like, pocket threes, we can just kind of assume, like, I might just want to do a strategy of betting everything better than pocket threes that's in my range, and then also betting as many bluffs as I need to balance that.
Right.
And I have no shortage of bluffing candidates. Like, one of the big constraints on thin value betting is that sometimes your range just isn't wide enough to, like, you can't be... You don't have enough bluff candidates to balance all those thin value bets, and so you can't bet too thinly. In a case where your range is really wide, you know, when we say the top of your range, that could mean something like 10% of the deck.
Yeah.
It could be like the top of your range when your range is huge.
So in that type of situation where you need a larger than normal betting range, then maybe you want to include some of these quote-unquote marginal hands in that betting range. Otherwise, you won't have enough hands to bet.
Yeah, because, like, what else could you... You know, like, if you're checking a lot of your strongest hands, then, like, those become your strongest hands. You know, when after you check the turn,
right?
Those become, you know, closer to your strongest hands. And if you know that you're ahead of his checking range, then, you know, his only option, once he weakens his range by checking,
right?
If we assume that's true, that he's not checking a ton of strong hands on the river, then, you know, he just is playing a bluff catching game.
Right.
He's checking the river, and his only option is either to call the river with a lot of weak hands or get run over by bluffs.
Right.
And so I just have to figure out which hands are strong enough to be ahead of the weak hands that he's going to call with. And then one of two things has to be true. Like, either he folds a ton to the river bet or he calls with hands worse than 5-7.
Right.
And if I knew for sure that he's going to fold a ton to the river bet, then I don't want to bet the 5-7. I would just want to bluff a lot, but it wouldn't necessarily make sense to bet for thin value. Like, against someone who you know for sure is going to be way too tight with their calling range, it doesn't make sense. Like, you can exploit them by not making the thin value bet, by just bluffing a lot and only value betting strong hands, because there's no sense in betting a hand that's going to win when you check behind but lose when he calls a bet.
Right.
But against someone who you don't know what they're going to do, or you know that they will call appropriately or that they will call too much, then you do want to have the thin value bets in there.
Right. For balance.
And just for value, I mean,
yeah,
you're
yeah.
you're ahead. You're, yeah, you have the true. Best hand.
Can I say something only tangentially related? Are you done talking about the strategy of that hand for a second?
Yes.
So when you say that when you tank for a while, it's pretty obvious what you're thinking about, you can use that both ways. So this actually relates to a hand I played yesterday. So if I can go back to talking about mixed games here for a second. So
no, I think for permanently it would be better.
So I raised the cutoff with ace-6-4-3 single suited to the ace in Omaha 8 or better. It folds around to Tim Finn in the big blind who calls. Flop comes king-king-queen with a flush draw I don't have. Check, I bet he calls. So I don't like my hand very much right now. So, ace-six high, not very good. Turns a five, so I still have no pair. Check-check. River's a nine, he checks quickly. And so the big bet is 400. He has 700 left, and the board is king-king-queen with a flush draw, five turn, nine river. I have ace-six high. And I start to tank a little bit, and eventually I decide that I can plausibly be tanking as a way of thinking about a value bet, because like Tim also has not, like, he was willing to make calls and things like this, so I eventually tank for like 20 seconds and then bluff, and then that seems like a good play.
Okay. My question there is, like, both of you guys brought up the issue of time. So the time that you're tanking, in Andrew's case, kind of dissuaded him from betting because it made look like he's bluffing. But
I think it was more, it makes it look like I'm thin value betting. Okay, actually, was my argument.
But do you have a good idea of what you look like while you were tanking beyond just the time? Because like if you're squinting up your face and you look you look like you're in pain, like that's gonna look differently than those guys who like tank like a statue. Like, a lot of times I see those guys.
Oh, you've watched me play before. What do you think?
I mean, you have a really menacing poker face, and, you know, it's not easy to get reads off of you. But I'm thinking and this is not like a spot where this guy, you know, shoved for your entire stack, where, you know, it may be harder in certain spots to hide the fact that you have a tough decision. Like, I don't even know if this counts as a quote unquote tough decision. So because of that,
just spent 20 minutes talking about
right. I mean, tough in the sense that it's not painful if you get it wrong. I mean, it's like you're deciding whether to win what's in the pot or win a little bit more, as opposed to deciding if I'm going to gamble and lose everything I have on the table at this time. I guess that's what I mean. And so the way you would look in those two spots may be slightly different, and maybe that can affect what your opponent is going to do if you tank for a while and then bet.
Yeah, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. I think that's right, which is all the more reason to sort of be generally disciplined and not sort of lose your composure,
right?
Like, ever, even when you're pretty sure you're just going to, like, make your muck face and lose.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah.
Better just not to make your muck face and let yourself try to fake a tank thin value bet.
Yeah. You know,
it worked. He folded.
Nice.
It was an important pot. Like, it's like 2K. I mean, that's like, I mean, I guess, what? 800 pre 800 plus a small blind. You know, it's like 1700 in the pot. That's over a third of a starting stack. Like, that's really, you know, getting those decisions right makes a big difference. And if you're going to play one of these limit tournaments.
So you have a triple draw hand, or do we already talk about that one?
I've got a triple draw hand and a Badoogie hand. Probably the triple draw hand is...
I'm more confident in my ability to follow a triple draw.
So Tim Finn opens. The guy who doesn't... A guy who's probably not a triple draw experienced player calls. I call out of the big blind. No, sorry. I three bet the small blind with 8-7-6-5-2. And it goes call. Right away, I've got a decision. Either draw to a seven or take a bad eight. I decide Tim is opening wide, and the third player in the pot is likely to draw even to a nine or something like that. So even a bad eight is going to have some playability. Also, there are three people in the pot, which can sometimes lead you to think that a lot of the low cards are already out there. I think I'm not going to get raised. I'm not going to be put in a lot of tough decisions by getting raised real thin a lot, so I'd rather just play my bad eight and go from there. So I decided to just play it as a pet hand. In the worst case, I might be able to draw to a seven later, but that's going to be unlikely. I do have a convertible hand, but I'm just playing it as a pet hand. Okay, I three bet, call. Sorry, there was a limper. It went limp, raise, call. I three bet. The limper folds. Call. Okay.
So that's kind of another argument for three betting.
Yeah.
Well, I guess there's no question about three betting. It was just whether or not to bet.
I think so. Yeah. That's right. I mean, if I'm going to draw one, I would like to do the same thing with all my one card draws, I think. And if I had like 8-7-4-3, maybe that's probably a fold. But like 8-7-5-2, no, then I might just draw to 7-5-2. Yeah, so that's not, I would like to do the same thing with all my one card draws, and I would probably cold call some of my one card draws. So I would like to maybe cold call all of my one card draws. And then, so if I'm going to break off the 8, I should decide that before I make my preflop decision.
It seems like driving that limper out of the pot.
Yeah, that's
there's some value there.
Yeah, that's right. So I
and the big blind too, if you just let.
Yeah, and especially given the way these people were playing, I'd be more inclined to just three bet all my one card draws and go from there. Yeah. Especially given that there are these tournament considerations, and even if you blow up the pot, you've got some bluffability later. So I three bet. It goes fold, call. I'm Pat. Tim draws two. The other gentleman draws one. Bet, call. Then it goes Pat to Pat, which is interesting because I just got called with a Pat hand. That makes me feel awesome because, like, if he had a better 8, he's probably raising. And it goes bet, fold, Tim folds, and the third guy calls. And then it goes Pat. And even though there's been, you know, I give away the end here. I think this is a clear value bet on the end. I think he would have raised a lot of his 8s. And I think it's a case where if you're playing triple draw by a bunch of formulas, like usually if it's a three-handed or even in some sense four-handed pot with a lot of action and it goes to the end, I mean, I can't beat hardly any 8. I've got 8-7-6-5-2. Very often that's not a hand worth a bet on the end, like when you have people drawing and improving their hands and you have all this action. But in this case, given my opponent's experience level, given the fact that he didn't raise me on the turn, even given some physical information, and given the fact that if I check, I'm just going to get value bet by a better hand anyway, because I'm probably not going to fold, right? Then that's it. That's a case where I just have to, like, you know, buckle up and bet the river. And that would have gone even for a lot of 9s. Like, even if I had, like, well, I guess, I mean, like, 9-8, I probably would have checked. And a 9-7, I probably would have just drawn to the 7 to begin with. Maybe, like, exactly 9-7-6-5-4, where I didn't want to draw to a straight draw all along.
Right.
Then that's a hand that I might check the river with. But everything else, I think... it's just a case where, even though it's scary, you got to think through the hand and bet your hand and not sort of play by the formula of, oh, a really bad 8 is not a good hand on the river in a multi-way pot with a lot of drawing and a lot of action.
Yeah.
So that's the lesson from that one. Makes sense?
Yeah.
Disagree with my play anywhere?
No, it sounds reasonable to me. I also don't feel that confident to disagree with your play. So.
All right. It's a lot of fun. Man, that tournament's great. It's... these 4 p.m. tournaments, though, they go very, very late. I managed to play till 3 in the morning and bust.
Yeah, I was following you on Twitter, and it was like, I think you got really short at one point, and then you ran it back up, and I'm thinking, like, man, Nate is actually going to, you know, just yo-yo all the way to the final table here.
That was the goal. That was the goal. But, you know, at the end of the day, there are a lot of little tricks you can do to keep yourself alive in a limit tournament, but it's a limit tournament. You got to catch cards.
Right.
You're going to get in a Raz pot. There's going to be no folding. Everybody's going to have odds, and sometimes he's going to hit, and you're not. And that's how it goes.
Quick question about that. You talked about when you had the, I think you called it a bad 8.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of other people in the pot, and so you said that the low cards were probably already out there. I recently read something and learned that that's a concept called bunching, I think. Okay. And how... some people try to use it in no limit.
That's right.
Is this something that you read or that you heard us talk about with Leo? Did Leo Wilpert, we talked about that with him. Like,
did he mention TJ Cloutier?
Yeah. I mentioned TJ Cloutier.
Okay, so I thought I read it. Maybe I did listen to the Big and Focal podcast.
It could be that somebody's like plagiarizing the podcast.
No.
That would be funny.
I do remember hearing that Cloutier uses it and how it's not that effective and hold them, but is that a part of good triple draw strategy?
I think it can sway close decisions. I mean, the real answer is I don't know. I think I remember Death Donkey mentioning something about this in a video once upon a time, and he's one of these people who's forgotten more about triple draw than I'll ever know. Mm-hmm. It's Chris Bitch, I think, is right. His name. Yeah, but I think, in multi-wipe odds, I do think it matters a little bit.
Okay.
That said, I'd be happy for anybody who really knows this issue to write right. in and, that, and correct me.
I guess my question is, if I was going to read a triple draw book, there wouldn't be a chapter on bunching.
There wouldn't be a chapter on bunching, but there might be notes to the effect that... there's this interesting...
You may want to consider it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because, like, in Hold'em, in big multi-way pots, you want to be in there with suited connectors. You want to be there in hands that... I mean, you also want to be in there with ace-jack, right? But you want to be in there with hands that can beat a lot of players. And that's true in all games. And so, intuitively, you might think that in triple draw, you should break off the seven and try to make a seven that's a really strong hand that can beat five players, right? Not all the time, but a lot of the time, and more often than an 8-7. But there's this counterbalancing effect where if five people are in there in the first place, then a lot of the cards are probably out of the deck, right? So your eight's probably going to hold up more often. So and which of those two factors predominates, that's just a math question that I don't exactly know the answer to, but it did weigh into my thinking a little bit here.
Gotcha. Well, and like a big difference between Hold'em and Triple Draw here is that in Hold'em, lots of different types of cards are potentially playable. Yeah. I mean, big cards are somewhat more playable than small cards, but people are folding ace deuce in early position. People are playing 7-6 suited and king queen. So the fact that someone chooses to play their hand doesn't give you that strong of a sense that they have big cards. Yeah, and the fact that they don't play their hand doesn't give that strong of a sense that they must have had, small cards. Yeah. Where, in a game like Triple Draw, only small cards are playable. Yeah. So, if even as bluffs, or like if deuce, seven is like a really good hand to stand pat with and try to bluff, because that all of the best cards are accounted for. So whether a person is playing a hand as a bluff or as a value hand, it's an indication that they have a lot of small cards, and that's not as reliable an indicator in Hold'em.
So something funny occurred to me just now that probably occurred to most people who play these games, like the first day they learn strategy. You just pick up, like if you look at your hand and you pick up a raw flush, you just muck it.
Yeah.
that just occurred to me. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, some people can't resist bluffing with it because they think it's funny,
deuce game.
But it's... Yeah, Royal Flush, unplayable. I mean, in practice, what usually happens is they muck face up and get a mild reprimand or not because they're so...
Can't help it.
This was another thing that the possibly Portuguese or some gentleman said. Like, one of the things they got reprimanded by the dealer for is, we all drew one, and so, my opponent to the right discards one, I discard one. He holds his hand up right in front of me and says, I have a nice... straight. Throws away one of the cards. Don't talk about your discards.
Can we hear the Badoogie hand?
This is one that I don't have all my notes about because it happened as I was playing a bunch of hands in a row and the game was playing fast paced. It's another one of these tournament hands where in a cash game I would have tried to get a lot of bets in, but in a tournament I didn't think I could get a lot of bets in no matter what. So yeah, I raised the button with a three-card seven draw, with three-card seven. Small blind calls. Small blind was loose. Looking to play hands or go home. Play hands and win or go home. Mm-hmm. Big blind is a stud player. Three bets. I think he's got a Badoogie here a lot. He three bet quickly. Oftentimes this is like a subconscious thing where he's got a Badoogie and he doesn't want to get outdrawn on and playing quickly. He thinks it's a way to accomplish that. I find I have a temptation in this direction, too.
And just quickly, for people who don't know, a Badoogie is four cards, all different suits.
And different ranks.
And different ranks.
Yeah, that's
right. I actually didn't know that.
Yeah.
Again, why I didn't play the technique.
So I call, and small blind calls. And it goes two pat one. When I say it goes two pat one, I mean the small blind draws two cards. The big blind, who is the three better pats, so draws into zero cards, and I draw one card. Check, bet. I brick off. I call the bet. And notice here that a 3-card 7 is not good. A 4-card 7 would be very good, but there are some cases where like an incomplete hand can be a value betting hand. But first, I don't think this guy's snowing, so I think he has a Badoogie. The average Badoogie is, depending on whether he's 3-betting all his worst Badoogies, it's going to be something like a queen or maybe a very bad jack. Anyway, if I hit my hand, I'm probably going to win. But my hand is worthless otherwise, unless he's snowing, which he's not. Okay, so I call, small blind calls. Hand goes, I think the small blind draws 2 again, so it goes 2-pat-1 again, and I make a 9 Badoogie. And notice again that if I think he's 3-betting all or most his Badoogies, and he really should be,
a nine is
fantastic. Strong lick bull. Okay, so then it goes check, and he bets. And here, because I think if I raise, he might slow down with even like a jack or a 10 Badoogie. I actually just call and try to hold him dead, and also try to keep the small blind in the pot, which I think I did. I can't remember, but so hold him dead is when you just call a bet when you could raise to keep him from breaking a hand. So if he had a hand like queen 6-4-3 or queen 7-4-3 or a hand like that, like if I raise, if he thinks that I'm only raising with Badoogies that beat his Badoogie range, he can break off the queen.
Right, and then draw line.
Yeah. So if I call, it looks like I'm still just drawing, and that can be a way, especially in tournaments where you really want to win the pot,
right,
that can be a way to hold them dead and guarantee that I win the pot, unless the small blind outdraws me, who I let in. But that's unlikely. If he was on a 2-draw, like, so I think it goes bet, call, fold, then the river goes pat, pat, and then he check calls. So that's that. It's possible I cost myself a bet if he would have called the river, but I'm not sure. So I think either I broke even or possibly I cost myself one bet, but possibly I saved myself the pot too. So which of those factors predominate? Again, that's a math question I haven't done yet. I just woke up and I was up till 3:00 last night, but it's something to think about. Like in a cash game, that's a fish play. I should raise and try to get 3-bet by 10, you know, and I should try to get in more bets. In a tournament where I'm probably not going to get a lot of action anyway, where there are tournament considerations and where I'm very often not even costing myself one bet in the first place, I think trying to hold him dead is a better play.
I'm kind of curious how wide he should be calling after you pat behind him. I mean, it seems like that's an awfully strong play on your part.
Yeah.
I guess you can.
What if I made a queen 7? What should I do there?
If you improve to a queen 7.
Yeah. What if I hit my queen?
I guess it seems like it should be a check behind if you're thinking that he's 3-betting. I guess you're saying a queen 7 is a good queen though.
No, I'm saying a queen 7 is a hand that I would probably just call as better than pat with. I'm saying there are Badoogies that I could make where I wouldn't raise him. So you're saying that once I call, then once I pat and bet the river.
Yeah, it seems like you need to be pretty strong.
Yeah, that's right.
Am I wrong about that?
No. I mean, that's right. I guess, yeah, maybe I'm saying inconsistent things here. Maybe I'm thinking that he's not going to put in 3 big bets with his Badoogie. But I do think, because he might fold the river if I raise, but this other play that I'm making shows a lot of strength too, and he paid that off, so why wouldn't he pay off if I raised? Yeah, that's a very fair point. I don't know. I do think there are at least some scenarios, and maybe like there aren't that many of them, so it doesn't matter that much. Like, I think if I'd hit exactly a queen, then okay, then I would call. But once he checks the river, then I would say, like, okay, he would probably value bet a jack, and the average queen is worse than a queen 7, so I've got a value bet here, and maybe he even has a king or something like that, so I can bet my hand. And then if he actually does have,
But there's the question of, like, why should he call a bet with those hands? I mean, might you be snowing here?
He might think I might be.
I guess it's an okay spot for it. The other guy's drawing two.
Yeah.
He doesn't need to be that strong if he's pat from the get-go.
Yeah.
So if he's just consistently, like, check-folding queens, I guess that's probably pretty exploitable by snowing.
Yeah, that's right. That said, you don't see a whole lot of that, and I'm not sure he would expect that from me. Yeah, I think this is revealing that I'm not a Badoogie expert. I like your line of questioning here. It's Yeah, it's possible that I'm not going to get that same bet on the end. And it's also possible that if I did get a bet on the end, then I really did cost myself a big bet. Yeah, so that said, I did keep him from drawing. That might have a little bit of value, even though he probably only had five outs against me. So that's the other thing, is like holding somebody dead can be a better play in triple draw than it can be in Badoogie, because usually your opponent is drawing thinner. So the value of getting him to not draw goes down. So yeah, so maybe
I thought that was interesting. That bet about holding him dead. I hadn't heard that exact term before, but I like that.
Yeah.
See, I never heard it, but I think I understood it to mean something similar to in hold'em, where you're in late position with a hand that you would normally three bet against an open, but you decide to just call with it because you think if you three bet, he's going to fold hands that you dominate.
Yeah.
So is that?
Yeah, it's sort of analogous. It's sort of. I mean, there aren't any exact analogies, just because there aren't drawing decisions in hold'em. But like, yeah, I, you know, keeping bluffs in a range, I think, is definitely something like that. It's like, yeah, it's like, oh, I just, yeah, I mean, keeping bluffs in your opponent's range, or letting your sort of very skeptical opponent think that there are still bluffs in your range. It's like, oh, I would love to just call, but I have to make a min three bet to keep bluffs in my range to let him like go crazy.
Right.
Like, it's yeah, no, but that's definitely yeah, there are certain analogies here, certainly.
Right.
All right. Well, anything else we want to talk about today?
Yeah, I had a couple of funny little things I'll close out with.
Very good. Okay.
You guys know, I guess I mentioned on the podcast as well, I drove out here with my cousin and her three children, who are all under the age of 10. And I've been doing, or I'm in the process of doing, and probably by the time you hear this, most of it will be up on my blog, a pretty thorough write-up of that. So I don't want to bore you too much with stories here. You can find the full story on thinkingpoker.net if you want to hear about driving from Maryland to Las Vegas with an 8-year-old, a 4-year-old, and an 18-month-old, and doing it on a pretty limited budget as well. It was certainly an interesting time, and I'm glad that I gave myself a few days to recover here in Las Vegas. But there were a couple of kind of funny poker-related things that came up on the trip, because the kids do know. I don't think they know that much about poker, but they do know that, like, that I play poker for a living, and I've talked on the show about trying to teach poker to the oldest boy, the 8-year-old. So the one funny thing, just that the night before they dropped me off in Las Vegas and they were continuing on to California, I played a bunch of crazy eights with the older boy Henry, and there's, I would say, any skill there is in crazy eights is extremely trivial. So you know, he ended up winning 6-4, and we were having a good time, kind of like trash talking and that sort of stuff. And then he, via his mother, sent me a text message the next day when they had left me in Las Vegas, saying, "I hope you're better at poker than you are at crazy eights." Which I liked getting trash talked by an 8-year-old.
Fantastic.
The other one that was pretty funny was at some point, They asked me, like, why I played so much poker, and I said, well, it's kind of like my job. And then the 4-year-old was like, poker's not a job. And I asked him why poker wasn't work, or why it wasn't a job. And he said, in a job, you get your money, and you don't get your money took away. Which, yeah.
Yes. He's a pretty smart kid, man.
Well, fair point.
This next story is about to contradict.
Okay.
So we were playing. Actually, I was driving, but their mother was playing Go Fish with the 4-year-old Oliver and the 8-year-old Henry, and was trying to teach just like the absolute basics of strategic thinking to the 4-year-old Oliver, and he's just not getting it. Like, so you know, she would ask Henry, "Do you have their the Go Fish game that they have literally has like fish on the card. So there's like the puffer fish, the nurse shark, the whatever. Those are the only two I remember. So, you know, she would ask the older boy, like, Henry, do you have a puffer fish? And of course, like, Oliver is really bad at concealing his hand. So she can see his cards and she knows he has a puffer fish.
Mm-hmm.
So she asks, and Henry says, no, I don't have a puffer fish. And now she says to Oliver, okay, Oliver, what card do you want to ask me for? And he's like, nurse shark. And she's like, no, Oliver, what card did I just ask Henry for? Puffer fish. So what card do you know that I have? Puffer fish. So what do you want to ask me for? Nurse shark. Like, just not getting it at all. And the funny part is that, like, I've had conversations that aren't that different from that with like adult Hold'em players.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
What do you think Hay has? Probably a flush. Why'd you call? I had top pair.
Yeah, I get that sometimes at cash games where I'm like the nittiest player in the game, and I probably win 80 to 90% of the pots that go to showdown. And, like, you know, I will bet, and then somebody will call and say, I know you got it. I call. Nice hand. Like, I hear that so many times. It's like, if you know I had it, why do you call?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, sometimes with opponents who are, like, very insensitive to bet sizing, like, you know, you get to sometimes it's like, wow, that's a big bet. That was a very large bet. I mean, I called. But, you know,
yeah.
That was a large bet.
I said, why so much? That's like, I hear that all the time. Yeah, why so much?
Yeah. Because I have the nuts. And I know you're going to call.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right, anything else you want to say before we sign off here? Can I just say thanks to Poker News again for this amazing setup? This is really fantastic.
It really is. And it was good to meet Rich after watching him on the Poker News podcast and reading so many of his articles. It was good to meet him. Yeah. One of the many people that I've met in poker. And so him, and then I was thinking some people may know from the podcast that I went to Atlantic City with Andrew in November, and we stayed at his cousin's house that the kids that we're talking about, and like it just always goes through my mind how would, you know, this black hip hop fan from Atlanta end up sleeping on the couch of a family of white farmers in Pittsburgh, if not for poker.
Yeah.
And no terrorism was funded during that trip.
Yeah, that's.
Although a bank was robbed.
Yeah, yeah. Funny story on that on the block.
Yeah, not by any of us.
Right.
I know you won't.
Love this game.
You won't.